You know, they say you just can't put a price on a mother's love. And that's great for the guys running a global racket that doesn't want to pay for most of what women do. I'm Matthew Remsky. That was an anti-fascist dad joke. Welcome to episode 11, The Communism of Love with Richard Gilman Opalsky.
So I don't accept this idea of love as a private power that is also a commodity. And so I insist instead on love as an activity, as an active relation, not a thing.
So that's coming up. But first,
it's like, I don't know how you can go out and protest the structure of the entire economic system if you can't keep your room organized.
Yes, that's the appeal to housekeeping from friend of the pod, Jordan Peterson. You can find me on Blue Sky and Instagram under my name and at YouTube as Anti-Fascist Dad. Also on TikTok under that same handle where I try to post mini essays a number of times a week. Our Patreon is at Anti-Fascist Dad Podcast, and if you go there right after listening to this episode, you will hear the second half of my interview with Richard, and you'll be able to catch up there. It's already up. And lastly, in the show notes, you will see a pre-order link for the book that this podcast is based on and supporting. It's called Anti-Fascist Dad: Urgent Conversations with Young People in Chaotic Times. It drops on April 26th. 2026. In fascist squish and anti-fascist news of the week, I'm going to keep it local this time with a single quote from a media scrum with the Ontario MAGA-style premier, Doug Ford. Here he's basically summarizing the Fascist Capitalist Alliance in a single answer to a reporter about a Canadian manufacturer of armored cars getting a contract from ICE.
Our manufacturer in Brampton provides armored cars for a lot of people. Yeah. ICE, the enforcement agency in the States, has just ordered 20 cars from ICE.
That's fantastic. I've been through that plant. They make great military vehicles, and now we need the federal government to start ordering some as well off them. And maybe they are, I'm not too sure.
Don't you see it's ironic with the tariffs?
I know it's ironic, but that's all right. We'll take orders anywhere in the world. And thank goodness that the Americans are ordering it off us. They're a great operation there. And maybe you should go and pay it a visit and see all these great employees building armored vehicles.
I don't know if you can hear it, but if you watch the video, there's a little bit of a smirk there. It's almost as if he's like nodding and winking and nudging his business buddies as he's speaking to the press out of the other side of his mouth. There's a style of fascist comms strategy in Canadian right-wing politics that comes straight out of hockey culture, where the whole vibe is skating around with a puffed out chest and a stony face, almost looking for a fight. Ford takes this question as though he's the bully who just knocked someone down and now he's getting a dirty look. And his answer is, oh yeah, what are you gonna do about it? So yes, ICE has contracted 20 Senator armored vehicles for $10 million from the Rochelle Company facility in Brampton. This is just west of Toronto, where I live. And Brampton is kind of like a specialty auto manufacturing hub. ICE placed the rush order on the grounds that Rochelle alone could meet its technical and delivery requirements. And that might have something to do with the fact that none of its four plants globally are unionized. I don't know. But the contract was signed in late November with a 30-day due date, which is just a blindingly fast turnaround on an order like this. So Rochelle was founded by Soviet-born, Israel-raised Roman Shimonov, who spent 15 years in the IDF, after which he got into the business of selling encryption services to defense clients, including the Israeli military. His new company's business has exploded with orders from Ukraine, as well as contracts with Department of Homeland Security, Department of State, Customs and Border Patrol, as well as policing units in Brazil, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Costa Rica, and Moldova. The Canadian Defense Review has named Shimonov Canada's Defense Executive of the Year for 2025. Now, what does Shimonov have to say about the contract? We don't sell to ICE. he told the Globe and Mail, we sell to the U.S. government. But then he also wondered aloud, why don't they report on companies that sell socks to the U.S. government? And it's a frivolous and insulting answer because we know that ICE sole sourced the vehicles from the procurement documents. And I'm sure Shimonov knows that socks don't violate human rights. You can't use socks to separate families. You can't use socks to conduct illegal deportations. No sock can run a squalid detention facility. Now, Rochelle and Shimonov are by no means alone among Canadian companies providing arms to fascist governments. Canadian firms, contrary to government assurances that military exports to Israel following October the 7th would stop, exported over $30 million Canadian in military goods to Israel in 2023 and almost $19 million in 2024. And independent researchers have identified nearly 9 million more Canadian dollars in aircraft parts exports in just the first half of this year. Now, there's something about these stories in which reporting out all the slimy details feels both scandalous and banal. It's scandalous because it's really hard to believe that anyone with a conscience would sell weapons to facilitate war crimes, but it's banal because it's standard practice. Arms companies routinely sell weapons to governments that are widely known to be oppressive or to be committing war crimes. Throughout the 20th century, this pattern was a structural feature of global arms trade, shaped by imperial rivalries, Cold War geopolitics, and of course, profit incentives. So when Shimonov says, we don't sell to ICE, we sell to the government, he's not just being an evasive jerk. He's echoing the old trick of the arms tycoon, deferring responsibility for how the equipment will be used to the government. Now, of course, the buying government will say that the reasons for the procurement are classified. And then the selling government can turn around like Doug Ford and say, hey, we're allowed to buy and sell. What are you going to do about it? So all the way up the line, you find one jerk after another shrugging their shoulders and filling their pockets. Now, who are the squishes in this segment? Well, you could take your pick of mainstream news outlets reporting this in some matter-of-fact tone, but they absorb that tone from industry and economy wonks who comment on the success of Rochelle's business model as if that success wasn't soaking in blood. In learning about what Shimonov has pulled off here, I went through a bunch of automotive blogs, fact sheets, and business reports, praise quotes from Brampton politicians, as well as the Canadian Defense Review article on him. And what I learned is that Rochelle's boom is solutions-based, meaning he's solved money problems for his clients. Armored vehicles typically cost over $1 million each, sometimes much more, but the senator's unit cost is half that because Rochelle builds its military capsule portion on a Ford F-550 chassis and cab. So this is Ford's heavy-duty chassis that firms can purchase off the assembly line for modification. It's just the cab and engine and the flatbed with the back axle and wheels. And the Ford plants are already pumping out between 1 and 2,000 of these units per month in North America. Now, anyone can purchase one of these chassis and do what they want with it. But if you're Shimonov or any other reseller who wants to benefit from Ford's ongoing support of the vehicle with warranties, its global parts network, existing emissions certifications, and service bays, they have to get vetted as an official upfitter by Ford, demonstrating manufacturing competence and ensuring no modification voids the warranty. Now, Ford gives out its qualified vehicle modifier sticker to firms based on quality, engineering, safety, and facility standards. But you know what they explicitly don't check? End use. What will the truck be used for? There's no buyer who has to disclose whether the truck will be used for military, police, or border security applications. No buyer has to pass a human rights assessment or screening. So behind Shimonov shrugging his shoulders is the entire Ford family, giant size, shrugging their giant shoulders. It's none of their business how Christy Noem wants to use these trucks. And this is standard practice as well, because all that human rights stuff falls to the government. So you can be assured that our feds are looking carefully at this contract, right? Under the Export and Import Permits Act, that should make everyone feel good about things because the act mandates a human rights risk assessment and a review of the sale against Canada's obligations under the Arms Trade Treaty. But, oh no, Canada has a long-standing U.S. exemption under the EIPA because we're such good neighbors and trading partners, which means that many military and dual-use goods exported to the United States do not require individual permits. But not to fear, here is Defense Minister Anita Anand on December the 3rd.
The government is not involved in the transaction. We have not received any questions or permit requests regarding this transaction. And I will continue to reiterate that Canada and the United States have a strong bilateral relationship with an open line of communication in which, if necessary, I will raise the issues with Secretary Rubio.
So the dog ate my homework, but we are committed to the process and the ideal of homework, and we hope to have a good dialogue about homework going forward. Remember that this is about a week into Rochelle's 30-day timeline for filling this order, which again is lightning fast, and this tells me that they absolutely expect approval, and that where it matters most, there is no moral daylight between the economic objectives of the government and the profit-seeking of the firms working under that government. And with this one, there's a hidden benefit as well, as far as the government is concerned, which is that a deal like the one between Rochelle and ICE displays the potential for rapid militarization of civilian supply chains. Government and arms companies become indistinguishable, and that's why you'll find statements from all levels of government that sound like this one from Patrick Brown, the mayor of Brampton. Quote, "We are thrilled to welcome Rochelle to the city of Brampton. This $65 million investment marks a significant milestone in our city's economic development and demonstrates the momentum here in Brampton. Our city's strategic location, diverse talent pool, and vibrant business community make it the best place to invest. This collaboration reinforces our commitment to fostering growth, innovation, and prosperity in our city. Thanks to Rochelle for choosing Brampton as the home for their new production facility," unquote. Now, in anti-fascist news this week, I want to shout out NDP MP Jenny Kwan from Vancouver East, who's not ignoring the end-use question, as Patrick Brown is. Back in September, Kwan tabled a private member's bill called C-233 to remove the U.S. exemption and clamp down on export end uses.
"We can no longer turn a blind eye to the back door by which Canadian arms are ending up in the wrong hands halfway around the world, contributing to gross violations of human rights and ongoing complicity of war crimes."
Now, for listeners unfamiliar with parliamentary order, a private member's bill is private because it's brought to the table by a member of a party that is not part of the ruling majority. It's basically the MP acting as a private citizen to put forward a law that cannot pass, but that opens the subject up for debate, which will unfortunately move far slower than the military business cycle, but it's something. Hopefully the labyrinthine Rochelle story helps to illuminate just how different the world my guest today envisions. Richard Gilman Opalski is a professor of political science at Illinois University Springfield. He specializes in the history of political philosophy, continental and contemporary social theory, Marxism, capitalism, autonomist politics, postmodern philosophy, critical theory, and global uprisings and social movements. He's got a bunch of books, including Unbounded Publics, Transgressive Public Spheres, Zapatismo and Political Theory, Spectacular Capitalism, Guy Debord and the Practice of Radical Philosophy, and Precarious Communism, Manifest Mutations, Manifesto Deturned, and a few others. But today, we're going to be talking about his incredible book, The Communism of Love, An Inquiry into the Poverty of Exchange Value. Oh, and do you hear that music underneath? the drumming especially. Richard is also a highly skilled improv, jazz, and experimental music drummer. And here he is with his friends Ye Big on bass clarinet and Adam Larison on guitar in Springfield. He's been playing drums since his parents bought him an Animal from the Muppet Show Kids drum kit when he was 8. So that's very cool. And we talk about that a bit as we get into our conversation. Now, Richard's book is about how the capitalist system fails to appropriately value the experiences and relationships that human beings treasure most. And for Richard, love, if it's taken out of its common tit-for-tat transactional forms, can function as a communist power that challenges the logic of capital in organizing our lives. Love also expresses a universal longing for a communist-type relationality. And when that's frustrated, it can manifest in revolts aimed at creating or restoring humane relations against a monetized existence. Hello, Richard. Welcome to Anti-Fascist Dad.
Hello, Matthew. Thank you for having me.
It's a real pleasure. I think you're probably an anti-fascist dad, too, so I think we'll find a lot to, you know, confer about. I didn't realize, this is my first question, until I read your book, that I didn't really have a definition for love, which is very strange, actually, for a concept that I think we think about or we feel our way into or we use as a term, throwing it around quite a bit, you know, in various contexts. It's very strange that I didn't really consider the definition of love. And so I wanted to ask, why do you think this is a big hole in the culture?
Yeah, well, I think that love is one of many concepts that people don't bother to define because they are repeating a given definition. So there are other words like that, words like freedom.
Right.
Democracy. People talk about those are in constant circulation. People use those words all of the time without bothering to think that they might have to define them. So, you know, that was a point that Isaiah Berlin made a long time ago in his famous essay about liberty, is that you have to stop and think what you mean. If you ask somebody what they mean by words like freedom or democracy, you'll find that it's not so easy. They've been using them all their lives, but they don't quite know how to think about them. And I think love is a word that has a word and an idea that has also a given meaning. It's something that is derived from the context in which it circulates, right? So when people talk about love, they're giving it a meaning. And I think it's not a very good one. And so it like other important concepts in our lives, it requires interrogation. It requires definition.
There's a very fancy concept that I sort of remember from my college days. And I think it comes from Derrida or somebody like that who described terms like this. They said, these are transcendent signifiers and they are words that we don't ask questions about. But he added something to it, I think, which was that when you don't add your sort of definition, when you don't really know what you're saying, the word can actually, it can take on a kind of aggression with regard to, you know, forcing a meaning. Like if everybody assumes that they know what freedom means, then, you know, the ICE agent and, you know, the protester will both be using it. And there won't be very much, there won't be any harmony there.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a very important point, and it just so happens that I was a student of the late Jacques Derrida.
No.
Yeah, at the New School in New York when I was a graduate student, and he was there as a visiting professor. I think that's a very important insight of Derrida's, which is that there's force behind the meaning of a lot of words that are given. You don't necessarily discern the force, but in the way that words are established with very specific meanings, there is a force, there are interests behind it. And that's part of the reason why Derrida insisted on deconstructing the meaning of texts. And he was very focused on words and ideas. But love, is the force that establishes the given meaning of the word love is problematic because it's rendered a kind of private affair, that it's the meaning of love is shrunk down to something that is the private property of families or lovers. And often too, with love in my research, I found that it's treated as a commodity, that it's something everybody wants. And then the question is, how do we get it? And if you give love, you may get it in return. And this commodification of love, and I would say privatization of love, is actually not some natural thing having to do with love in the world. Behind that meaning is force.
Okay. Well, I think this gets us to your, I'm going to ask for a 50 word, let's say high school level answer for your idea of the communism of love.
Okay, well, I'm going to not count my words.
Okay, I won't either.
Maybe I have a high idea of what a high schooler is capable of, but I'll be as short as possible. So I don't accept this idea of love as a private power that is also a commodity. And so I insist instead on love as an activity, as an active relation, not a thing, right? So it's an active relationship, not a thing. And it's not a terribly original insight. It's not something I can claim. Erich Fromm wrote extensively about love as an activity. For example, great sort of Marxist critical theorist and psychoanalytic theorist. And so if love is an active relation, then what kind of relationship is it? And so often in my work, I talk about how, you know, if you have a friend and you say you love your friend, and you come to your friend in a time of need and you say, I'm going through something awful and I desperately need you, friend. And your friend says, of course, Matthew, I'm there for you 100%, but it's going to cost you $15 an hour.
Right.
That is exactly your friend telling you that they're not a real friend. I mean, if your friend charges $15 an hour for friendship, they're telling you that they're not your friend. So it's not an exchange relation. So love relations in friendship, in families, in society more broadly, it is not an exchange relation. It's an active relationship that doesn't follow the logic of capitalist relationality. Capitalist relationality is exchange relation. You can get lots of things in our societies in exchange for labor, in exchange for money. It's a web of exchange relationality. You know, I don't tell my fifth grade son that he can have food and shelter in exchange for labor. And that's because I love him.
Right.
All right. And so a love relation is opposed in a very fundamental way to the logic of capitalist exchange relations. So in our active love relations, I find what I call a little experience of communism. Right. And so that's the communism of love in the shortest way I can give it.
Okay. So it's not 50 words, but it was very concise.
Thank you.
And I think that what I want to pull out is something fundamental about love as something that can't be commodified ultimately, because I guess the way I look at it is, when you are in a loving relationship, there's no keeping of accounts. Like, you can't actually assess or measure or evaluate. I mean, it's all priceless. So is that at the heart of this problem of love being seen as something that you could exchange, and that means that it's not really love?
Absolutely. I mean, the fastest road to resentment in human relationality is a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
I mean, if you try to quantify, human relationality and reduce it to measurable units, I always do the dishes, I always make the dinners. If you reduce human relationality to quantifiable units, that we give and get, in exchange, then it's not just a fast road to resentment, it's entirely an uncritical acceptance of the capitalist logic of quantification.
Right.
And what we're seeing in our societies, and we've been seeing it for a very long time, is the abandonment of qualitative assessment of everything. Everything is reduced to quantifiable, commodified units. And love does resist that. It is not compatible with that kind of a forcible reduction to measured units on a spreadsheet. But we nonetheless often try because we accept a given understanding of love, which needs to be challenged and overturned ultimately.
You know, there is, I don't want to use the word economy, but there is a sphere of love that I think is subconsciously acknowledged by capitalist systems in the sense that it must be ignored. And here I'm thinking about the unpaid labor of, you know, the domestic environment, the unpaid labor of women, where if you acknowledge that actually the nonstop caregiving of parenting work and homework should actually be valued or remunerated in some way, then everything about capitalism has to change. And so there is an acknowledgement, I think, that unpaid labor is running the world in some way, and that is a kind of expression of human love, but it must not be acknowledged. It has to be sidelined. And I'm wondering if that's sort of essential to the way we're actually organizing things in capitalism.
It's absolutely essential to the way that we organize capitalist society, to the organizational logic of capitalism. What you were just talking about, Matthew, has been very well explored by Marxist feminists,
yeah,
particularly from the Italian tradition. If you look at writers like Silvia Federici or Leopoldina Fortunati, Fortunati specifically has talked about what she calls the secret workshop. And this entire history, I mean, Federici has written about this as well, this very long history of unpaid labor, which enables the co-production process, which enables the whole political economy of capitalist societies.
Yeah.
And then when finally there is some confrontation there, as the Italian feminists and in New York as well did with wages for housework, and they press and they say, you know, we should be paid. The real challenge is in the fact that it can't be paid for. Imagine the back pay. It's impossible. The whole history of capitalism depends upon, you know, this endless extraction of surplus labor, which is gendered.
Yeah.
And it is also, as you rightly point out, and Fortunati is very good on this point as well, it is also dependent on a certain abuse of the concept of love, right? So that the woman works in the secret workshop for free because she loves her family.
Right.
All right. And so if she loves her family, she shouldn't have to have wages for love.
That's its own reward. If she is seen as loving, then that is its own reward.
Exactly. So then in that context, the concept of love is weaponized against women in that setting of domestic labor.
This show is about how parents and caregivers and children supporting each other can actually be or is fundamentally a political act, and I believe can naturally teach us about anti-fascism. And you have one paragraph near the start of your book that for me really sums up the kind of wisdom that the parent or the caregiver, I think, has to develop if they want to get the most out of this idea. So your overall point is that, you know, loving someone means wanting to participate in who they are becoming, even when you don't know what that will look like. And in the passage, you focus on your kids. So I'm going to just read it to you and ask about certain ideas on the way. Quote, "With my own young children, presently 12 and 5 years old, it is not controversial to say that they are not yet the beings that they are becoming." Okay, so I don't think it's controversial either, but why is this so hard for some parents to really accept?
Well, this is a great question because it really gets to the beating heart of the problem of love as an activity. It's hard for parents to accept because partially, there are many reasons I would say, but part of the reason why it's hard for parents to accept this is that we are not supposed to not know. Parents, I mean, this has something to do with a particular model of parenting, are supposed to have answers. That's one part of it. That's not the whole answer. But I claim that there's a huge epistemological limit point for every parent in the activity of parenting. It's really hard to know what to do as a parent. And any parent who knows exactly what to do, I'm suspicious of such parents.
Well, you can find them on Instagram telling other parents what to do. I'll tell you
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. And right. Some of them write books. And yeah. I read some of those books before my firstborn son arrived. And, you know, I think it's a problem because we don't, I mean, I sometimes wonder, I was reading a book by Franco Berardi called Quit Everything, in which he argues it's not even ethical to bring children into this world.
Right.
This world is a place that does immeasurable harm, not only to children, but definitely to children. Children living in a war zone, children surviving or trying to survive a genocide with their families being blown apart. And even in other parts of the world, living inside of a frenetic and psychologically precarious world full of anxiety, insecurity. And in psychology, there's this really crucial concept of future-oriented thinking. And psychologists will tell you to worry if your child if there's no evidence that they're having any future-oriented thinking. But what is future-oriented thinking for a child raised in a world where they think that their lifespan is longer than that of a habitable Earth?
Right.
I mean, we're living in a time where we don't know how to do it. And I think we have to sort of not pretend to know everything that will happen. There are a lot of things. My older son was really into soccer, was great at it. We sold all that stuff at a garage sale. And we never saw it coming that my younger son would get into soccer, but he has. A son... in many families becomes a daughter.
Right.
My older son has become a pretty impressive musician. And a child born into an evangelical household grows up and becomes an atheist. So the destinations are unknown in many ways. And then the question becomes, so what is love's role if we cannot know? Like, if we cannot know how to do this, if we cannot know, and if we're suspicious of the knowledge of experts on Instagram who know every answer to every problem of parenting, but if we don't believe that and we can confess a real epistemological limit point in parenting in the world, such as the world is, then, you know, I think we have to ask the question, what is love's role? For me, it seems quite clear that when you love someone, you have to try to actively participate in their becoming what they are not yet. You know, and I got that concept, the not yet, from Emmanuel Levinas, who writes about, you know, possibilities on the horizon. As a communist, as a revolutionary, I'm intimately committed to possibilities, horizontal possibilities of becoming, not just of family members and friends and comrades who I love, but in the world that we live in this upside down world that we inhabit, which I think we have to say has to become something else. So we don't have to know exactly what the world will become. We don't have to know exactly what our children will become. But as human beings, we have to try to participate in transformative becomings.
I think it's the opposite of the anxiety of control as well, which is really, I think, what a lot of the parenting based upon the expectations in your particular investments is about. It's like, if I do this correctly for my child, then the outcome will be X. There will be success in this realm, or they will have a good job, or they will be set up for this particular experience. And, you know, I suppose it's always going to be natural to look ahead somewhat to some, you know, beneficial or, you know, I don't know, enriching circumstance that you would want to have. I think that's very natural, but it's very easy for those parental investments to become almost like, I don't know, mutual funds or something like that, you know, some sort of economic, some sort of, you know, best guess that you can make on the marketplace of your family life.
Yes, I mean, I completely agree with this, that we have to move away from thinking about human beings as a financial investment or modeled after one. But, you know, this point about looking forward and having to have some horizontal idea is very good. Mm-hmm. And it's not something I wouldn't argue we should abandon that.
Yeah.
We have to use our imaginations. We have to think about what is desirable and possible in politics and life. We have to have some things to aim towards. And I think that many parents struggling with that epistemological challenge of knowledge, of not knowing, they then go and grab the developmental maps. They reach for them. And can you blame them? Can you blame us?
No.
I mean, you want to know, you know, where should my child be at 9? Where should my child be at 11? I mean, many families, this is part of the problem of capitalism, they only know their own. And so you kind of, it's natural to say, show me the map. How many friends should a child have in fourth grade? How good should they be at this? How proficient in math? How good in conversation?
Oh, can I just pause you for a moment?
Yes.
I think you're pointing to the fact that in, let's say, the conventional nuclear family, there's sufficient isolation from other ways of being parents and children in the world that you don't have access to, you know, multiple forms of developmental tracks, right? So
yes.
in the village, let's say, you might understand that so and so learned to read this way, and so learned to read that way, and it happened at different times. And in the interim, they were doing different activities anyway.
Yes.
But in the absence of that, what you're saying is, parents are going to turn to the stats, they're going to turn to the textbooks, and they're going to turn to the school curriculum, and they're going to say, well, I'm going to be worried if my child doesn't meet these, you know, evidentiary-based benchmarks for when they should be reading whatever. Is that's what you're getting at?
Exactly. And the feedback that we get from so many schools across the world it gives us comparative measures of development in different proficiencies, academic and otherwise. They have, it's very common in the United States increasingly now for some decades to focus on SEL, social and emotional learning. So it's not just math and reading.
Right.
But the problem is these maps don't necessarily work for neurodiverse children. These maps don't necessarily work in people, for families situated in different ways, economically, geopolitically.
Right.
And they may not even work for neurotypical children because these maps were written in a different time. They were developed in a different time and technologically, right, and ecologically and psychologically, I would say on those three areas specifically, technology, psychology, and ecology, so much changes so quickly that we really need to rethink the map all of the time. So right. I mean, I think it's hard to throw away the map because for many parents, it's the only way that we get some sense of how we're doing, how the school is doing, how the community is doing, how the family is doing.
Right.
But it's a very problematic way to deal with human development.
So I was in the middle of quoting this paragraph. I'm going to get back to it. You write, but what do I want my love for my children to do in the world? Do I want to ossify my children just as they are, making them into static objects of my love? This is in no way an ultimate hope or aim, in no way the interest or orientation of love. What I really want to do is participate in their becoming what they are not yet, but could be and desire to be, a future being that I cannot yet specify, a being to be determined. How does one participate in a person becoming what they ought to be when neither the love nor the beloved knows yet what he is? How can I assist my beloved children in becoming what they are not yet, beyond my own limited sense of possibility? This is precisely what I want to do with my love for my children. Okay, so these are sentences for the ages, I have to say, Richard. And I just want to say, like, how long did it take for you to come to this? Because I don't think this is just about study.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very hard question for me to answer. My best guess is that it probably took my entire life up to the point that I wrote those words for me to come to them. Part of it is coming to a certain orientation as a parent in the process of parenting.
Right.
Right. So you have some experiences with human flourishing, as it were, as trying to participate in the flourishing. I quite prefer to think of human flourishing instead of human development because of a lot of the problems of the concept of development associated with the concept of development. But in that sense, I would say that my children played a dialectical role in the development of my view.
Right.
But then there's also other variables. I mean, I am a philosopher. I am a revolutionary. I'm also an improvising jazz musician.
I did not know that.
Yes. In fact, my next book, which I've just begun, is called Revolution and Improvisation. And the subtitle is the epistemology of not knowing what will be.
Oh, wow.
And so it's really about creating or participating in the creation of something, or co-creating or co-participating in the becoming of something without knowing exactly what it will be. And so I had those orientations as a musician, as a philosopher, as a revolutionary before I had children. But certainly my children, my experiences with parenting, and then there's also the research into love as a commodified concept, the idea of love as a commodity itself, which many other people have dealt with. So you're right. It's not just scholarly research. But I also hope that sort of these very particular contingencies that are so personal about me and my life, my hope is that there are some insights there that are generally resonant widely. One doesn't have to be a philosopher or a improvising jazz musician to understand what I want to say about the communism of love.
I've known a lot of musicians. I've done a fair amount of music myself. I never was able to improvise because my training in piano and then pipe organ actually later was really by the book and quite rigid and non-exploratory. And that's kind of like, it's something that I kind of grieve. And if I ever get back to a keyboard, maybe I'll try something else. But it makes me wonder whether practicing, you know, knowing what the sort of basic patterns and possibilities are within, you know, your basic tune, and knowing that you're going to take it somewhere else, but you're not necessarily going to leave the planet, although you might, and then you'll come back. Did that teach you something about the moment of uncertainty in parenting? Because I can imagine that there are a number of improvising musicians who are fine doing that on their instrument, but then when it comes to their kids, something really locks down in them.
Yeah. I mean, Matthew, I want to just push back on the first point that you made when you said you were never able to improvise. You were. When you first sat down before a piano, the first moment that you put your fingers on the keys, when you're trying to figure out what sound it makes, it's improvisation, it's experimentation. If you give a young child a toy drum or a xylophone, it's improvisation. And then when you say by the book, you know, the book comes in as a way of saying that you can't do this very well, you can't do it right, you can't do it you can't achieve excellence by improvising. And so I think, you know, I think I was quite surprised, naive as I was about being a parent, how much I would need to improvise. I mean, so much of what I've had to do as a parent is improvisation. And it is a kind of collective improvisation because you have to respond to what the other person is doing, whether it's your partner, whether it's other people in society. So there's a whole collective improvisation. And I do think that people they're not comfortable improvising, which was a part of your own point as a piano player, right? I mean, it's a level of comfort with improvising, but I think that improvisation is necessary.
Right.
And it requires a certain openness, and that perhaps we will see may get us more concretely to the question of fascism. Because there were certain forms of music that fascists in the 20th century despised for many reasons.
Well, exactly. You know, I loved that so much. I just can't do Anti-Fascist Dad this week. My heart isn't in it. So that's the show. In part two with Richard, we continue our discussion of music and jazz. We look at the tension between fascist modes of total control and the need for freedom in development and radical politics. We talk about how the loving orientation of organic communism has to be deprivatized and extended beyond the family sphere to address broader social issues. And we also talk about how the best ideas often need to be smuggled in by teachers within highly controlled educational systems that resist, you know, concepts of human flourishing. Next week, I've got a special Christmas solstice holiday time story for you all. Until then, take care of each other.